Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
It has taken more than four decades for the families to get justice. They have tried and tried on so many occasions to prove the point, of course, that there was negligence on behalf of the owners of the Stardust. Now, it seems they have got their justice. And if you weren't listening to the news today, you would have heard that all 48 victims are now, the families are now in a situation where they've got the justice and they've got the verdict of unlawful killing. Joining me to give me a little bit more information about the tribunal and exactly where it went, or the inquiry, I should say, and where it went, is Alison O'Reilly from the Irish Examiner. Alison, good evening to you.
How are you on this momentous day?
It is. You know what? It's hard to be sad, or it's hard. I'm really happy for all the families of the victims.
Yeah.
And from that point of view, it is a celebratory day. But it must, every time this comes up, it must bring it all back to them again. And I was looking at some of the pictures today online on RT News, and this young lad was 16. There was another young lad who was helping the DJ, last seen at the DJ box at the stage. He was only 17. Mm-hmm. You know, and all these young kids whose lives were just ended that night.
Shattered, yeah. Mm. Shattered families and the ripple effect. And all, you know, how North Dublin had suffered so much. And I know there were families on South Side, but this was a North Side disco, you know, the biggest there.
Yeah.
And they had fought so hard for 43 years and so many letdowns. Even when they got the funding for these fresh inquests, it took another, what, 2 or 3 years to get it off the ground.
Yeah.
And it was scheduled to go on in the RDS. Do you remember? They ran out of time, and then it was booked for something else, and then it had to be moved to the Rotunda. I don't know how they kept going. I really don't.
And in that 40 years, I'm sure many of the victims' families have passed away, so they won't they won't get to see the justice that they were originally fighting for going back 20, 30, 40 years ago, because... Yeah. Every Valentine's Day, of course, the story appeared in the paper again. The families were calling for justice. And eventually they've got their justice. Sure, it took them long enough just to get the memorial park that's there. I mean, it took them long to fight for that even.
That's right. I went to Kalash Sadulik. I did the communications course out there, and the Stardust Park is right beside that college. Mm-hmm. A lot of the kids went to the school, Kalash Sadulik, and... I remember the fight to get that done. I was in college in the 90s, and I was like, why is this taking so long?
Yeah, yeah.
It was absolutely desperate. Absolutely.
It was like this kind of denial. Now, I know many of them were compensated, not enough, mind you, but it was like this kind of denial that, sure, look, that's the way it was. You know what I mean? Now, don't get me wrong. I worked as a DJ in the industry in and around that time. And, you know, and I remember chains being put on emergency exits. And the reason for that at the time seemingly was that if, you know, Johnny didn't get in, his mates would get in and open the back door and let him in. And that was a kind of common. It wasn't just, by the way, in nightclubs. It was cinemas did the same thing as well. It was it was very common practice. By the way, we have a lot, and I don't want this to sound the wrong way, we have a lot to thank the victims of the Stardust for and that tragedy. Yeah. Because from that moment on, the regulations all changed. You know, everything that had to be fire retardant. There was no way you would ever have a broken emergency exit door again because they were checked on a regular basis by the Dublin Fire Department. You know, and remember we used to, when I worked in Club M, you know, we'd always talk about the Stardust. The fire officer would come in once every 2 years to give us all a talk and, you know, what happens if there's a fire. And the Stardust would always be mentioned. And the first thing he'd say was, Club M is safer than your own home because of the regulations, because of the
what it did for others. You're right, because people were smoking inside, and you know, this whole thing of leave everything behind.
Yeah.
Like, that was one of the things Antoinette Keegan always said, you know, they were grabbing their bags and things. And like, now that's just totally unheard of. And that's because of the regulations brought in. Like, I grew up in Drogheda, you know, and my mother used to always say, now remember, the Stardust victims, you know, if there's a fire, just leave. And she was always at this. So I...
And where did you go in Drogheda? The Rosneree, probably, the place.
I went to the... No, I never went to the place. I went to the No Name. Okay. And I went
to the Earth.
The Boxing Club. The Boxing Club was a fire hazard. It was an absolute disaster. Mm. It was falling in. Mm-hmm. I think that's why they closed it. It was condemned. Then I went to Luciano's. But Luciano's. And we were always told to just get out.
Yeah.
Get yourself out. That was the whole thing, and leave everything behind.
But for these sad, for these victims, 48 of them, and not only the 48, because a good friend of mine who was there lost all his fingers because he was trying to help to pull people out and his hands were on fire.
Yeah.
And by the way, he's traumatized for life because of it. And a lot of people would be traumatized for life.
Yeah.
And there's so many people who had life-changing injuries because of the Stardust. It was the biggest tragedy in Irish history, probably. Well, certainly in the latter half of Irish history, anyway. I mean, it must be a great day for them to finally think that, you know, they're looking up at the sky at their loved ones and saying, we did it, we did it.
Yeah, I think they were still in shock, though. It just, as you know, Antoinette Keegan was at the forefront of this
campaign.
She's
worked tirelessly,
Yeah, like since day one. And she's a survivor of the Stardust as well, you know. So she remembers it. She's got that trauma. And the minute she starts telling you that story, she goes back there. And it's so traumatizing to listen to her. She remembers everything. And then she lost her two sisters, Martina and Mary. And so, you know, her mother, Christine Keegan, like, she was at the forefront of that campaign as well.
Yeah.
And there were so many people who died along the way. Eugene Kelly, like, these people were all the ones that were fighting, trying to keep it going. Because you can imagine a big, all those families, some people just say, I can't do this anymore, I want to give up. Trying to keep them all together for 43 years to get this justice is very, very hard. And it was strength in numbers. But obviously, there's always, you know, very prominent people at the head of any campaign like that. And it was an incredible campaign, you know. And I suppose today, when the verdicts were read out, you know, I think, like, they stood up and they, you know, they clapped for the jury. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of tears. They took their time coming out. Antoinette's first words to the media was, I'm overwhelmed. But calm.
But she was probably prepared for disappointment again, because that's all that she's had for 40 years.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, even though you're listening to that 100 days of evidence and you're thinking, you know, well, this is it. This is definitely it. They've had so many disappointments. You know, I mean, probable arson was one of the findings, you know, all those years ago. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, these awful
reports. That's astonishing, by the way, that
yeah,
there was a possibility of that.
Yeah, absolutely disgraceful. Yeah, and the families all kind of took the stand up in the Garden of Remembrance one by one. And a common thread of everything they said, you know, they thanked the media, they thanked their legal team, they thanked the coroner, the jury, you know, all their supporters. But a common thread in all of their speeches today was, you've given us back our families. We've taken them from the ashes and the flames of the Stardust, and we've put them into the sunshine and, you know, nature, and you've given them back to us. They're no longer a number. They're resting in peace. And I just thought, that's
heartbreaking.
You've
isn't
carried,
it? Yeah.
You've carried that for 43 years. A family's lost in ash and dirt and flames and trauma, and they had not had any sort of freedom or peace. You never get full closure on that. You couldn't possibly. I mean, the trauma of it all. But
I remember the Stardust. I worked there one night.
It.
So I do remember it, you know. And I can envisage how it happened.
It
was. And it was like any big function room. They had sections of it partitioned off. And, you know, the place was huge. It would, like, it would hold 1,200, 1,500 people on a busy night, because in those days there was no restrictions, right? Nowadays in a nightclub, your fire officer will come in when you build your nightclub. They measure the square footage of your dance floor. And then they decide you are allowed to have a capacity of so many people, because it's so many people per square foot or per square, whatever it is, or per so many meters square per person. So they decide, you know, you're licensed to have so many people. In those days, there was no such thing as that. Okay, so it was just as many. How many can you squeeze in? And that's unfortunately what happens in these kind of situations. But they had this section, you know, which was sectioned off. And that's where the fire started. According to the inquiry, there was an electrical fault, which might have set a sofa on fire. But because in those days as well, you know, everything was done on the cheap, they had polystyrene suspended ceilings. And the flames had gone up into the ceiling, up into the roof space, and gone right across the whole building, the top of the building, before anybody had even noticed it. So at that stage, I can only imagine the tragedy of this polystyrene dripping flames.
Oh my God.
And everything it was touching was catching fire. You know what I mean?
Oh my God. Like, and Antoinette explains that very detailed and very graphically, like, because she's so traumatized by that horrific memory. And honest to God, when she tells it, you can just see it. And you're thinking, oh my God, oh my God.
Because I know there's people listening saying, well, you know, why couldn't everybody just go? You know, get out of there quickly. Surely a fire doesn't spread that quickly.
No, no, and that's one of the things they found today. The doors were obstructed. Well,
they were all obstructed.
This was the ball of contention the whole time. Mm. You know, the carpet tiles on the wall, yes, that contributed to it. You know, the response of everybody inside, that contributed to it.
The panic, probably contributed to it.
The panic, yeah, there was no problem. You know, and then, you know, were the doors obstructed? Was that mean something was in the way? They were bolted, they were locked, which, you know, it's obstruction. And they found, yes, it was. And I thought, oh my God, because there was so many rows over that. And you're speaking about DJing. Colm O'Brien was the DJ in the nightclub that night, mm-hmm. and he flew in from Boston mm-hmm. for the inquest.
Okay.
And he kind of said he was listening to all the names being read out, and it was those things he said where you're thinking, did this really happen? Mm. You know, because people suppress those yeah. horrific memories.
Yeah.
And you know, so many people just were so proudly standing up today and speaking out, holding up pictures of their loved ones, and saying, "I feel vindicated. I feel like, you know, you've given us back our family. I feel like, you know, Alison Coker Keane," she said she was just 12 when she learned her sister Jacqueline Coker, 18, had been killed. And these were all 18, 19, 20-year-olds, you know. Mm. And she said, "I feel the truth has been outed and justice has been done eventually." You know, but it was so emotional. I think while they all spoke so well and they were crying and they were cheering and they were clapping, you could still see shock. It's going to take a long time for that to sink in properly. You got your justice. You got your tidal wave of justice. That's what I said. Mm. It was a Seamus Heaney moment, because it's very, very hard to get justice when you go up against an establishment. And they did.
Yeah.
And it's extremely hard.
And they were, they believed as well, of course, they were disrespected so many times, you know, after the fire, because, of course, the owner reopened the building again. And a lot of our people, obviously, you know, that left a really bad taste in the mouth of the local community, of course, because such tragedy had happened there. And imagine opening a business, you know, on the site where 48 people had lost their lives and hundreds had been injured. I mean, it just seemed so disrespectful.
Yeah, and they, you know, they've gone through so much hurt.
Yeah.
They've gone through so much anger and, oh, can you imagine the emotions they feel? Mm. And they're entitled to feel whatever way they feel, because they went through it. They lost somebody, and the ripple effect of that. It was friends, family. One woman, as you said, lost three children.
Three children on the one night, yeah.
Three children. And I remember Philomena Linus talking about that.
Yeah.
She said that that woman had brought her back to life, because she said she was up at Sutton Cemetery, where a lot of the Stardust people, just the victims, are buried. She was up there crying, and, you know, she was so devastated over the death of her son, Phil, you know, that for 5 years she just went to despair. And she said it was around Christmas or maybe Christmas morning, and she was standing in the snow like a blizzard, and she was crying over Phil, and why did you leave me? And it's, you know, my only child at that time. And she said in the distance she saw a woman down on her hands and knees wiping snow off the headstone, because in Sutton Cemetery the headstones are flat on the ground. And when she went over to help the woman up, she said she pulled back the snow and saw Stardust, Stardust, Stardust. And she said, here was I crying over my son who had drug overdosed and, you know, ruined his life. She was devastated over the death of her son, but she had said it was a different death. He had chosen to take drugs, and this is what had happened. And here was this woman losing three kids in a fire. And she said she took her home and warmed her up and gave her some tea. And that was a turning point for Philomena Lyons.
So that was just for people to know, that was George, Marcella and William McDermott, I think, with those three.
Yeah, and I mean, that always struck a chord with me, because I was thinking of Philomena today saying that was a turning point in her grief and her journey over her son, to say, well, hold on a minute now, you know, this is worse. And it changed her perception and put things into perspective. And it was incredible to watch those people, because anybody who knows carrying that level of trauma and injustice, it can kill you, divide families. Mm-hmm. Pull you apart, split families up, you know, all sorts of estrangements going on, you know. Trauma does that. And yet they were there today getting their justice all together, all of them.
Yeah.
I thought it was an incredible sight to see. It was, I didn't cover the case. Sean Murray from the Irish Examiner was there and doing a brilliant job, but I knew I had to go. Do you know,
yeah, you just had to be there to say, you had to be part of that. Yeah,
I had to go down and see it, and I have interviewed so many of the families over the years. So many journalists have covered this from the beginning, you know, and there was all of us know it. All of us know it. So we all knew when we got the word that the verdicts were going to be read out at 2 o'clock today that we all went. I mean, yeah, it was major turnout.
What happens now? Well, I know they're now calling on the state to apologise.
And they should.
Oh, well, they will.
Yeah, they have to. Like, that is... And a formal apology to every name them,
yeah,
you know. Put their names on the record and formally apologise to each and every one of them. Yeah. That's the least they can do. Because when you think about it, you know, for people who are only hearing the story for the first time today, you know, young people, it really boils down to this. How in God's name did it take 43 years for those inquests of 48 people who were killed in the fire in 1981? How did it take so long? Why? And I know there's 101 reasons, and they got the run around and they were treated like dirt for all those years, but it boils down to that. How did it take so long for these inquests to be heard and the trauma and the suffering extended on those families and no peace and people going to their graves, Christine Keegan, her husband, you know, it's beggar's belief, doesn't it?
It is mind blowing that from the very, very start. And I remember, I'm older than you, obviously, Alison, but I remember going back from the very, very start. You know, I would have been kind of in my 20s even at that time then. After this is happening, not in 1981, I was in my 20s, I was 16 or 17. But I remember on the news on a regular basis, the stories were coming out about, you know, when the original inquest was heard and all that kind of thing about, you know, the deaths, yeah, you know, that the doors had been chained locked and the fire had started here and there was a suspicion of arson and all these kind of stories were coming out, yeah, in the newspaper at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, so mm-hmm, why wasn't it all done then? Because we knew all the information that we had now in this inquiry, we had then.
Yeah.
We had all that information. Yeah, it's not, yeah, new information. Not,
That's the thing. Like, why did it take so long? And it's because nobody wants to hear this stuff. We talk about the mother and baby homes and that decades and decades of stuff as well. When you go up against an establishment trying to hold people accountable, and this was a massive disaster, this was a massive tragedy, people just don't want to know. They don't want to talk about it. And it only, you know, as you said, there was other inquests and, you know, but we heard today, you know, that the fire had started and had kind of been well underway before it hit inside. So people, yeah, had said they'd seen the fire outside and then the fire was inside and they were trying to match up the times. But they were saying, you know, it did start outside and mm-hmm, it must have been about 10 or 15 minutes. Can you imagine the destruction that had caused in the meantime?
Oh, yeah.
And it was an electric fault. And honestly, like, as you said, this is not new information. And yet people's eyewitness accounts and all that, they just were dismissed. They were completely and utterly thrown to one side and nobody wanted to hear about it. And it's awful. It's absolutely awful.
So the only exit was the door they came in, essentially. That was the only exit.
That's it. Can you imagine? I can't even begin to imagine the terror, the absolute terror that those people felt.
I remember speaking to one guy who lived in Eadmore at the time. I won't mention his name, but he was one of the local boyos, so to speak, at the time. He would have been known. Yeah. And he was a car thief. And, you know, he was among other things. But he was there that night. And it changed his life. I mean, such a nice guy. And I've met him numerous times since. Yeah. He's such a really lovely guy now. Wonderful person. But he was badly injured in it. But he went outside, stole a car from the car park, from what I believe, and then rammed the doors that were chained to try to get people out.
Oh my God.
You know, I mean, that's how desperate he was. I mean, the humanity in somebody like him coming out on an occasion like that. Yeah.
Mm.
And
total and utter helplessness.
Yeah.
And I mean, this like, even like, it was September 2019 when the former Attorney General Seamus Wolfe had directed the fresh inquest.
Mm-hmm.
That's 2019. So he directed that. And he drew analogies between Hillsborough and Stardust.
Well,
and he just
said,
you know, that,
So I remember the Hillsborough disaster. Jeepers, yeah. That was all. I remember watching that live with my mother on the television because she was a big football fan. I remember watching that as it happened.
I remember that too, yeah. Yeah, I remember that, yeah. My dad's a big Liverpool.
And a similar situation. The fire just, it started under the stand. These are the old wooden stands in those days, which would have had lots of rubbish under them and everything blown around in the wind.
Yeah.
And it started under the stand, and then before you knew it, the flame had gone over their heads and started coming down. And all these people running out onto the pitch, literally on fire. It was horrendous to watch.
Horrendous, yeah. Mm. And like, you know, he had directed that these things should happen, you know, that this fresh inquest. But that was 2019. And then COVID hit and there was money put aside, you know, in the budget for the Stardust inquest. But I mean, 100 days, but loads of delays. So it didn't just go straight into it. Oh, that's great. We'll set that up now, you know, for 6 months' time or 1 year time. Like, it just went on and on and on. And I thought, this is absolutely outrageous. Mm. You know, because they all knew what happened. They all had... There wasn't a person who had witnessed the Stardust that these families didn't try and track down and talk to. You know? Everybody
so
from
what's the
first responders to people that...
The bouncers on the night. Yeah, bouncers on the night who would have known what doors
they
or gates were locked.
They had to do their own research.
Yeah.
They had to build their own case.
Yeah.
You know, and really all they wanted was an inquest. Mm. A simple, straightforward, fact-finding inquest. And they probable arson and all this rubbish that just disrespected the memory of all those young people. People, like at the time, you know, I was only like a child and you're hearing all these teenagers died in the Stardust up to 2023, 24. And like, they're only kids.
Mm.
You know, when we look at it now, they were babies. Going out after with their few bobs.
Sure, in those days, well, it's the same as now, probably. You know, you had 16 and 17 year olds in the place because, you know, nobody asked for identification in nightclubs in those days. And it was a much younger crowd than there is now. So, Alison, what happens now? I mean, the verdict is unlawful killing. And people are saying to me all day now, so what happens now? Is that it? Or will there be criminal charges because it is unlawful killing? So will this go on now, or is that the end?
Well, you see, an inquest can't hold anybody responsible.
Absolutely,
It's a fact-finding mission, and it's to establish facts and causes of deaths and the circumstances around those deaths. So it's not about holding someone accountable. But what they wanted, what the families wanted, was the truth and justice of what happened. But unlawful killing is kind of like manslaughter, you know?
Yes.
And these deaths could have been avoided. So, you know, knowing the Stardust families, they're not going to leave it there. They have a fantastic legal team from the North, Phoenix Law. And I've no doubt, and I did hear people discussing this today, that, you know, they're going to seek legal advice on that finding. But an inquest is a fact-finding mission. Mm. It doesn't hold anybody accountable. So I suppose the next thing is to have the public apologies and give them a chance to take in the enormity of this hugely significant day. But knowing the fighters in those families, they will exhaust every avenue.
Well, I just hope that Simon Harris doesn't delay. It took a long time, for example, for Enda Kenny to give the public apology for the Magdalen Laundries and for the mother baby homes.
Too
way
long.
Too long. Yeah. So I'm hoping that he will do it and want to do it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, this has to be done like tomorrow.
I would. If I was his press officer, I would be saying to him, this needs to be done tomorrow or at the very latest on Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, or
because these families have waited. They've waited 4 decades already. Let's not make them wait another 4 days.
Start as you mean to go on, Taoiseach, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no problem in standing up in the Dáil and inviting the families in to hear it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Give them a chance, organise it, reach out to the families, you know, we're going to take a minute's silence, we're going to apologise. Come in if you want to come in, you know.
I personally believe the whole country should do a minute silence.
Absolutely.
I think that would be a wonderful thing to do after 4 decades.
Yeah, and it is. It's just a significant day. And it was so emotional today watching them all standing there holding out the big poster, Justice for the 48. And, you know, they all spoke so well and so eloquently, but most of them said, we knew all this already. You know, they died it was an unlawful killing in 1981. It's an unlawful killing today.
And you know it was hard for people too. And I had spoken to victims over the years and who weren't part of the campaigns. And many of them just wanted to move on with their lives. And that's understandable too. But for them, it was really hard. Not that it was the campaigners' fault, because they had to do what they had to do to get to this point today. But they felt, you know, hearing it constantly, it was every Valentine's Day, the story would come back up in the media, of course, because the campaigners were on the trail to try and get something sorted and get this done. And for them, or for the other ones, it was quite hard as well, because, you know, it brought back the memory and the trauma of it every single year. And the government are responsible for that as well. Do you understand? It's not the campaigners' fault that that happened. They had to do that.
No.
But the government are responsible for that.
No, because trauma is trauma, and it will affect you whatever way it affects you. You can't control trauma. It will affect some people where they block it out and don't want to know. Like, it's too big for me. I don't want to hear this. You can't condemn somebody for that. Mm-hmm. That is how they feel. Somebody wants to take up the baton and go for 43 years battling through the system. That's what they want to do. That is what's going to keep them going. You know, I mean, that level of fighting must take a massive impact. Take its toll on your system emotionally, mentally, physically. Every fiber of your being would be totally exhausted from that fight. But also for the people who want to switch off and just block it, that is still trauma. They're still carrying trauma because your body holds trauma. Your body never forgets trauma.
Well, so certainly not something like that.
No matter what you do. You never forget trauma. Your body doesn't forget it. You might block it out of your head, but your body will carry it. And I just, you know, it really is, it's such an important day. And that is why I said, I have to go in here. I've interviewed all of these people over the years, and I need to go in, see their faces and hug them and just be there and support them, because they said the media helped them, you know, lawyers helped them, their community helped them. And I suppose, you know, I just wanted to be there to see their faces and wish them well, because of the horrendous burden they've had to carry, for parents and siblings and, you know, lost loved ones. And remember, you know, there was a section of the cemetery where a lot of these victims were unidentified for quite some time, because obviously we didn't have the forensics. So
I was reading that today, that one particular girl was identified by her brother because of a bracelet he had bought her for Christmas. And that was that was the only way they could identify her. Somebody had dental records would have been another way they would have had to do it. You know.
And Maurice Fraser, you know, has his sister Thelma's jewellery, and Antoinette Keegan would have her sister's jewellery. Like, they got things back, and that's how they identified them. But he said, you know, they had to identify Thelma by her dental records, because there would have been a lot of denial then as well, couldn't be? No, maybe they just ran away and they didn't want to come back. Whatever way your body processes.
Well, you'd be praying. If you were a parent, you'd be praying that's what happened. You know, and as I said at the start, just to mention it again, like, at the time there was no social media. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have all the communications in the world that we have now. And yet, at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, my uncle rang from America. This had been covered on American news at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to see if we were okay, because he knew it was where we lived. It was near where we lived. And to make sure to make sure none of us had been there. So he rang all concerned, you know. That's how that story traveled the world. And again, it's traveled the world today. It's on BBC, it's on CNN, it's on Sky News. It's everywhere today. It's traveled the world again today.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, most people reading it today, are hearing it for the first time. They're hearing about this tragedy in Ireland for the first time, you know.
Trying to comprehend it. It's the biggest tragedy in the history of the state, biggest inquest in the history of the state, and a day for the families who fought for this, and a day to remember those who perished in that awful incident. I mean, nearly, you know, wiped out families with just the trauma of it all. But I think it's a day that we'll never forget, because I'm so happy for them in so many ways. It'll never change what they've gone through, but at least they're going to have some sort of peace.
Yeah.
Some sort of peace that they are now, it's now confirmed what they always knew.
Alison, thank you. And just before you go, I just want to mention as well, because obviously you've been following the story of the mother and baby homes, just a brief bit of information for those people who are looking for redress. The portal is now officially open, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And the latest figures from the Department of Children, I think, is about 900, just over 900 people have applied for redress since it opened on the 20th of March. I'm still meeting people who are struggling with the application form, but you can just ring up the number that's online and they will post you out a hard copy, because it's not very easy to log in and set up your own account. Yeah. Yeah, but it is open, and, you know, people with health conditions and the aging community go first, and only rightly so. But it's there, you know, if you're not sure, apply anyway. That's what I always say. If you're not sure, apply anyway.
And well done to you, Alison, because you've been tirelessly campaigning for that for years as well, and part of the campaign for that too. Listen, thank you very much indeed, Alison O'Reilly from the Irish Examiner. I appreciate you coming on the air tonight.
Thanks a million, Niall.
Loads and loads of people, by the way, texting. And somebody says, Niall, where was the Stardust? Because I'm a little bit young to remember this. Well, if you're familiar with Dublin, it was actually Artane Business Park. Well, that's what it is now. It's kind of just opposite the shopping centre, which is a very small old shopping centre, Artane Shopping Centre. It would be just opposite that. I don't know what they turned it into afterwards. I think it was like a carpet store, a tile store or something. And there was some business put in there, which certainly was a bit of a bone of contention with the locals. Because you've got to remember, you know, a lot of local people from Coolock and Edenmore would have been killed or badly injured in that fire. They all had families and relations who would all have lived, you know, in that area. So the idea that you would open a business or something, you know, on that site, and then, I know this sounds odd, but if it was my family member, the idea that people are going walking into a building that's been refurbished, that was originally the burnt out shell of the Stardust, where 48 people had lost their lives and hundreds had been really badly injured with life-changing injuries, and that you're walking around in that, you know, shopping or something like that, or whatever it was you're doing, or doing business in it, to a lot of people was completely disrespectful. And I can understand why they would feel like that. Okay, let me just go to, if I can, Mickey. Hi, Mickey. How are you?
Mickey, how's it going? Noel, yeah, just to touch on what you were saying there, there's something similar coming up here in Donegal with obviously the Chrysler tragedy.
Oh, yes, explosion, yeah.
And apparently they're going to try and build on that, and the families aren't too happy about that.
I can imagine why they wouldn't be happy, you know, if it, it was, you know what I mean? It just seems kind of sacrilegious, doesn't it, in some way?
Yeah, well, it's not far away from me, and one of my cousin's daughter happened to be in there at the time, and she was very lucky.
Yeah.
She just came away with slight injuries, but
shocking tragedy.
That, and I can see why that's from Artane. But to go into obviously I wasn't even born till the year after. But as you know, I lived in Swords for a long time, and one of my mate's dads actually was there that night.
Yeah,
and every so often, you know, when we after the pub, we go back up to theirs, and every so often he'd speak about it, and you could hear, you could see the emotion and in his face, his eyes, and that. And he was a bit of a hero, and he was asked to step up, and he was like, no, we just done what any man would do. And he helped to take a few people out of the place at the time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, can you honestly imagine being in that situation, being there and seeing so many people die, you know, around you?
What was it, 48 people? 48 you know, people. 200 injuries, isn't it?
Yeah, life-changing injuries, people with third-degree burns, etc. Can you imagine seeing that, the horror of seeing something like that? It would never leave your mind.
You'd never forget. No, of course not. No, it's something you'd never forget. And as I said, I won't mention him by name, but, yeah, my mate's dad, you could see the emotion coming out in him when he, you know, it would take something where, like, it'd be after the pub and we'd be back playing a few games of darts or something and having a little whiskey or something, and it'd be only then he'd kind of come out with something like it, you know?
Yeah, he'd open up and start talking about it, yeah.
He'd kind of open up then about it, yeah.
But isn't it terrible that it's taken 43 years? 43 years.
But there's still no one held accountable for it, though, has there?
Well, we won't talk about that now for the moment. And as Alison mentioned, it's only an inquiry which doesn't have any legal standing, you know, as far as criminal charges are concerned. But that's up to the families.
And they've only just found out what was the actual cause from a hot press for saying, wasn't it?
Well, the inquiry is now saying, you know, obviously unlawful killing. So that's entirely up to the campaigners and their solicitors and barristers as to what happens next after that. But the main thing that just should happen next is the state should apologise for it taking so long to get to this point.
But yeah, that's the point. You just took a point that I was just about to touch on. It just seems in this state that anything like this, when it comes down to if there's mass, whether it be few people killed or
injustice in general,
like that. Injustice in general, and it takes so long for this country to even do anything about it. Well, not the country, but the actual government. It takes so long for something to go, and they spend millions and millions, and even that. I know, obviously, it's classed as a different country. Look at the Bloody Sunday.
Yeah.
How long did that inquiry take? You know, and you know, I don't think there's really any justice there either when it came down to that.
No.
And it just seems to be the same thing in the country of Ireland. That look.
I mean,
happens. It's in the past, and look, we don't want to drag it up and that. But there's a lot of families out there, and I was reading a thing today about that related to the Stardust, that there's been some suicides related to that.
I could imagine so.
People that were there and family members that lost people in the Stardust.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And there's
so.
Been suicides attributed to that. So
someone has
to be held accountable, you know.
Can you imagine your son or daughter going out that night, you know, for a Valentine's night, for a party, 17, 18 years of age? They were all in around the same age, between 17 and 22, whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And they just never came home again. And that's, of course, part of their campaign. They never came home, you know. I mean, it's so traumatic. The last time you see them is with a smile on their face, all dressed up, going to a nightclub. Thankfully, it's not something that has happened since. And it's not something that will probably ever happen again, because and I mentioned this to Alison, we do have the Stardust to thank for the regulations that we have now, for the fire inspections, the fire safety codes around nightclubs and bars.
That's what I was going to say. There's a lot more regulations when it comes to fire exits and that. And it's
too late for those people.
Just something recently there during the week was another, well, it wasn't in Ireland, but it was the Hillsborough disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fans were classed by certain newspapers as it was their fault and all that for years and years.
Mm.
And they still haven't got any justice from it. You know that kind of way?
Oh, Hillsborough, of course. I made a mistake with Alison on that one. I was talking about another disaster, which was the fire in the stadium. But the Hillsborough disaster, of course, the Sun, of course, were very much involved in that. The Sun newspaper.
I didn't know if I could mention. But yeah, the Sun, obviously, and that it's something that's boycotted in Liverpool. And
is it still, it's still boycotted to this day,
isn't it? Yeah. 100%.
Is it actually sold? Yeah, it's not even sold, is it, in Liverpool now?
And most shops won't sell it now. And I think because it's not even that. I think it was, there was a Liverpool game recently and they booed the national anthem and there was uproar over it. But a lot of Liverpool came out and says, we don't class ourselves as English, we class ourselves as Irish.
You know, and that took a long time, by the way, that inquiry. Not as long as this, but it took a long time as well. You know? Well, stay there for a second, because I want to go to Lily as well. Lily, hi, how are you?
Hey, good evening, Niall.
How are you, Lily? It's bringing it all back to people, isn't it? The tragedy. I don't know how many people listening were alive at the time or were, you know, nightclubbing.
I know where I was. I know where I was. My sisters and my brothers and me at home and it with us. We were just crying. We kept crying I remember us all crying for a full week. And my mum and dad, we were all devastated. But Niall, do you know what I'd love to know? Now, I'm just saying this. You can tell me not to go into that detail. But I worked with my dad. I worked in insurance and we were agents for several different companies around the country at that time. And I always remember when people were in hotels and shops and had to have public liability and they had to have employer's liability, and we'd have to go and actually inspect a building where there was going to be maybe a nightclub. And what I can't understand is what insurance company or what agent went to that building and said
that's okay
well,
yeah,
like it was a jam factory, I think. I'm not sure. I'm not too good. I'm not up to date. But what person that was working in the insurance company went to that actual building and said, yeah, we'll cover this for public liability. Chains on the door, bars on the windows. At that time, people were smoking. people smoked inside and all that kind of thing. So it was more of a hazard at that time.
I think from what I remember, there was a bar. It was called the Silver Swan, if I remember rightly. And this was a function room, which would, you were right, it was converted from an old food factory. And and they converted it into a nightclub. Basically put, you know, alcoves, tables and chairs in and put a stage, and that was the end of it.
Just put a stage in.
Yeah.
And where was, I remember us doing this. I remember me being a DJ for a while. And I remember us going to certain hotels and town halls and places doing discos, and there was always public liability. And I'm going back further than 42 years ago, because I was 21 then, and I was doing the discos when I was about 16 or 17, and we always had to be careful. We'd say to the people, there's an exit there. And what really makes me mad, and I'm sorry for sounding so argumentative here about this, what really makes me mad is the fact that a human being that had a responsible job of going into that building and telling the person or the people who owned it, yeah, we'll cover that for public, we'll cover you, it's fine. Because to my knowledge, you had to inspect places for when people were looking for public debit. Like, there are 40, all those lovely teenagers and 48 people and the families and the relations. There's about this hundreds of people that were related to them, and it was just terrible. And I hope, and I really agree with what you said, that you said if everybody had a minute silence, I think that Simon Harris should hop on that microphone and say, the whole country, every town, every city, every nook and cranny in Ireland has got to light a candle for not alone the poor things that got burned to death, but for the parents, for the relations, for everybody involved. And if I were a judge, I would be in that court and I'd say, who's the person here that went in to that building and did inspect it from top to bottom? I mean, you don't.
But you see, the laws were so lax at the time. For example, on that particular night, in those days, you don't have to do it as much now. You had to get what they call a special exemption order to serve alcohol after 11 o'clock at night. Yeah. And the exemption order wasn't given as a disco. It was given as a dinner dance. Now, don't get me wrong, that wouldn't have been unusual in those days. It was quite common. For example, nightclubs were open under the pretense that they were a dance for the local residents of a hotel, because that's the license they operated under. But, you know, the laws in those days were so different, so lax, they weren't enforced. And I mentioned to Alison, I worked in the nightclub industry just after that period, because I was starting out as a mobile DJ in and around that time, 1981.
Oh, good.
And I remember working, and I knew a lot of the DJs, I knew people that were there and everything else. But I remember, you know, in the nightclubs at the time, it had been common practice to put a chain on, say, an emergency exit door. And the reason they did it in these places was, in case somebody didn't get in, they'd go around the back and let their mates in through the emergency exit. So a lot of the places had been putting locks on the emergency. I mean, it was, when you think about how scandalous that is, but they did it. And the other thing as well, you know, a lot of these nightclubs opened on the cheap. You know, there was cheap furniture, cheap carpet.
Yes,
now, that wouldn't happen now, because you wouldn't be allowed to open the door. The fire officer wouldn't ever let you open the door if that happened nowadays. Because I remember, I'll give you an example of how that changed the whole dynamic of the nightclub industry. We, in the 1990s, we were running a Wild West night out in a place called Faces Nightclub in Churchtown. And we had haystacks.
Churchtown?
Yeah.
Oh my God, my relations are living in Churchtown. Yes, okay. Go on, sorry.
And we had haystacks and hay all over the floor. And the fire officer came in. And I remember that day, that I and other staff members that day, we went around with a thing on our back, which had fire retardant in it, and we had to spray it onto everything, right? And on all the hay and everything else, because obviously that was the regulations. But the fire officer came in that night because he had heard about the Wild West night and heard there was hay. And he closed the door of the nightclub and said, close the door of this nightclub. You will not be opening it until I check everything. And he went around and he took out a rolled up newspaper and set it on fire and started sticking it into the haystacks. And he said, if one of these catches fire, you're not opening. And that's exactly what he did. So what I'm saying is the regulations became so strict. we have the people of the Stardust and the victims of the Stardust to thank going forward for no more tragedies, because what happened then could never, hopefully, ever happen again. You know?
My God, that is true. And that girl was lovely. Mm. The girl that was on there with you, Alison, she was very well spoken and she, lovely yeah. girl. I was very interested in listening to her speaking. Of course, yeah, I'd love to know who that. You see, that if I was a judge, there'd be a lot of things I'd do if I was a judge. If for crime, I'd be cutting limbs off, little fingers off, and saying, right, if you come in again here, you get another limb cut off. You have yeah. people that attacking people in houses. But if I were the judge, I'd say, who? But then again, as you said, it was different then.
Whether it's different then or not, you know, maybe people will be held accountable. I don't know. That's entirely up to the campaign, their solicitors and their families, and what they're going to do in relation to that. And I don't know the legalities of all that, but I do know that the inquiry in itself is not a criminal charge, can't find people criminally responsible. Thank you very much indeed, Lily. Bernie, just finally, because I've got about 3 minutes in this, Bernie. Bernie, do you remember the Stardust tragedy? Of course, you would have been a nurse and you would have been talking to fellow workers at the time who would have been maybe working in Dublin or communicating in around that time.
Yeah, I was. I was 22 years of age. It was the year I got married, and I had gone that Saturday night to the disco in Silks.
Oh, Silks! Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, we came home that night, thinking we'd heard there was something going on, but we weren't told anything. Like, I mean, the next morning when we went to work, it was just horrific. People had family. People, you know, friends were out there. They were searching. People were coming. Did you know? Did anyone come this way? You know, some of the hospitals. Like, it was unreal. It was the same, you know, like when we had, there was so much happened that year, you know, and oh my God, it was just tragic. I mean, and some of the burn victims, I mean, the burns they got were horrendous. And, you know, the bodies, some of the bodies were nearly unrecognizable, you know, and it was a horrific time.
Can you imagine being two parents at 4 o'clock in the morning arriving at the scene, the fire brigade there, and, you know, it just smouldering at that stage, maybe where they'd put the fire out, and knowing there were so many people dead inside, and people, a lot of people had been taken off to hospital at that stage, wondering, praying that your teenager was one that had been taken to hospital maybe and not actually be still in there. I'm wondering if they're still in there, because as you said, most of the people would have been unrecognisable, sadly. Can you imagine what it was like for a parent to be one of those parents?
And I mean, I remember talking to some of the people who had come out of the fire and telling us about the people who'd fallen, the people who'd tried to get out the doors. There was crowds around, you know, some of them had tried to push and three or four of them were found together. Like, reliving it is horrific, you know, and I was only a bystander. I was only like everybody else in Dublin, shocked and stunned. Like, there was no, do you remember, there was no buses late at night.
No.
You know, there was no taxis. Like, you went to your local disco, which was down the road or wherever you were, and, you know, it was a different time. And we all had our hair flicked back, like, you know, Farrah Fawcett and, you know, Betty Davis' eyes, I think, was a hit out there.
That.
And,
yeah.
And we had, you know, I think there was
the leg warmers.
Lady Diana was going out with Charlie, and, you know, like, it was a dear, and, you know, none of us had cars, really. There was a petrol strike. I think everyone was walking at the time. You know, it was back in a time nobody would ever remember what you were talking about, but that's what it was like. And you went out the door on a Saturday night, and your mother saying, make sure you have the key, or, you know, be back at 2 o'clock. And that would be your, there was none of this texting or mobile phone. That was it. You went out with your friends. There wasn't any drinking in your house before you went out. You might have gone to the local for a pint, and then you went to the disco. Like, it was the biggest night of the week for you. And Valentine's night, like, was super. It was a super night for us all. You know, like, we were all so loved up, and, you know, I was just engaged and I was getting married. And, you know, it was so exciting to be going out that night, and everyone was loved up, and the carpets were plastic, you know, nylon, Axminster.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd be sticking to it. You know, and you'd have your drink. Everyone had cigarettes lighting in the ashtray, and you'd be getting up dancing and smooching. And, oh, it was a different time.
Yeah.
You know, and to think that people didn't make it out. And I just remember all the anxiety, and everybody had knew somebody that knew somebody that was there.
Yeah. I'm looking at the top 10 songs that would have been out, you would have been dancing to at the time in those nightclubs. Don't You Want Me, The Human League, Tainted Love, Soft Cells, Stand and Deliver, Adamant, Prince Charming, This Old House, Shakin' Stevens, Ultravox, Vienna. The Specials, of course, were big at the time, Ghost Town. And you remember that horrendous song, the Birdie song?
Oh, was that out?
Diddle, 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 diddle. Oh my God, how do we even dance to that?
But as well as that, Niall, we were all wearing jumpsuits throughout, and you know, you could wear a skirt, you know, Japanese. Chinese dresses were big at the time, with the slit up the side, and she thought you were gorgeous. Your eyeshadow was that bright.
I know. Sure. I had the you know, the kind of bright white shirts and the side lace shoes and yeah. Bernie, listen.
Like, we were innocent. I'm so sorry, but sorry I divorced. But I think 48 years is way too late. It's disgraceful. That should, you know, never have happened that long. And those people, and listen to the night in the news. To listen to a daughter who lost her parents. I mean, they're disgraceful. They're just disgraceful, the whole of the last 48 years, people who didn't... Well,
previous governments, who failed them every single time. Bernie, sorry, I've run out of time. And once again, to all the people, by the way, who know somebody, who remembered somebody who was in the Stardust, or who even just remembers the night, because it was such a tragic night, it's such an impact on everybody. Our condolences to every single last one of you. And to those people who were injured in the fire, by the way, I know it was a very traumatic time for you, and I know it's something that will never leave you. It's like a life sentence, and I do believe that Simon Harris should call a national minute silence. I think it's not too late to do that, and to show our respect for the 48 people who died and all those people who were injured.
Now, real people, real opinions. Nighttime Talk with Niall Boylan,
Ireland's classic hits radio.